And this world and this period in Japanese history has never been depicted on screen, like anywhere near this magnitude.
All right, we got episode 4 of the Post Production Club podcast. I'm Gavin Buckland.
And I'm Luke Fritz. I'm very excited. I'm taking over the podcast today. And we have a very exciting guest, Michael Clayett, who is the VFX supervisor for the new Hulu show Shogun, which I'm sure you've heard of. He's an incredibly passionate guy who loves story. He talks about his journey into VFX, the future of the industry and AI, as well as what it's like to work on a big budget show like Shogun. So it's going to be a great episode. We're really excited. Let's dive into it. So welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks for having me. Pleased to be
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. I'm very excited. Very excited to talk about some VFX. I don't get to talk about it very much because not many people speak the language. So we'd love to start out to get to just know you a little better, to hear about where you're calling from, what you're working on, and kind of like your journey into VFX.
Yeah. So I'm based in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I'm originally from the States, but I've been living in Canada for the last 12 years. Came up here for a show and met my wife 3 months in, so ended up staying. It's not a bad place to raise a family, which is where I'm at right now in my life. When I was a kid growing up, I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark in the theater at a very young age. And I was really, rather than be freaked out by that last scene where the Nazis get their faces melted off and everything, I was really interested in how they did that, how they achieved that effect. And I did research and really looked into it. And I was fascinated by how they built the wax prosthetics and layers of the muscle and the skin and the blood in it. And then they melted it with a hot lamp and basically sped up the film to achieve that effect. So that fascinated me. So I was always fascinated with more behind the scenes, behind the scenes kind of thing. And so as I got, later on in life, I saw the opportunity to go to school for visual effects and animation. And so I did. I went to a school in Orlando, Florida, called the DAVE School, Digital Animation and Visual Effects School. And graduated at the top of my class. I worked really, really hard, discovered I really loved doing it. And at the end, when I graduated, I created this little 45-second space opera, this space bottle, spaceships and explosions and what have you. And I went out to Los Angeles, and I got a meeting with the guys at the time who were producing and making Battlestar Galactica, the new series at the time. This is back in the early 2000s. And showed them this, and they hired me right onto a Joss Whedon movie called Serenity, which is based on a series called Firefly from quite some time ago. It was really, really good. So, and then my career kind of went from there. I worked my way up as an artist through the visual effects houses. I was a bit of a jack of all trades. Went to India and as a visual effects supervisor, and did a few films in India, which really got my feet wet for visual effects supervision, and came back over here. And I've been a visual effects supervisor for like the last 15 years, and have been working on the production side, directly for the studios for about the last decade. Yeah,
that's awesome. Right, yeah. There's so many things in there that I want to hit on.
Sure.
Starting out, I am always curious. I'm somebody who went to school not knowing that I wanted to do visual effects. I actually have an economics degree, but I've been doing visual effects since college. But I don't have any of that kind of formal training. And I'm wondering if you feel like that's like really key if you want to make it in visual effects, if you need to do that, or like how that's helped you. And kind of like the effect that going to school for visual effects has had on your career.
I think it used to be more. It used to be more critical than it is now. I think there's, it used to be when I was going to school, you almost needed special computers to run the software. We had something called the video toaster back then for the rendering. It was being phased out right around the time that I went to school for this. And you still needed to buy, you needed to spend a lot of money on a computer to run the software proficiently or productively rather. And these days, you know, anybody can do it on almost any computer. And there's a lot of information online to find about it. That said, it's a difficult business to break into. It's also a business that is changing rapidly. It's going through a major transformation right now with the introduction of AI. And it's a business along with the rest of the entertainment business that is, it's a little bit in flux at the moment. I mean, Hollywood is through the strikes and the kind of after the strikes, the reevaluation of the business model by the studios has caused some turmoil and caused a lot of people have been out of work for a long time. Hopefully that's changing over the next few months. I see a lot of shows beginning to kind of kick the tires and get up and going. So I hope that's changing. But from a visual effects standpoint, like I said, it's a much different business now than it was when I started. And it's a difficult business to make it in. And I'm honestly, I don't know what that business is going to look like in the next few years here. So because it's rapidly changing, I believe that, I mean, if you really want to get into it, I believe artificial intelligence, I think what it's going to do, I think it's going to make the visual effects. I tend to be on the optimistic side. I think it's going to make the visual effects industry bigger, stronger. I think it's going to, Hollywood is even going to rely on it even more. To do more because we're going to be able to do more with AI. I don't think it's going to be phased out. I don't think the studios are going to suddenly pick up AI and start figuring it out on their own. They're still going to need people to do that, experts experts in technology and expert and creative experts as well. So we have that in many, many artists, but it is going to enable us to do much more as an industry. And I think we'll be relied on even that much more. So that's my take on it. Mm-hmm. I'm confident. I mean, I'm optimistic, but yeah. That's where we're going.
Yeah. I love that.
That's nice to hear an optimistic take.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I love that take. I love the approach of thinking to be more, how can we utilize this to grow out the industry as opposed to being totally fear-based? I think it's right to have reservations about a tool not being used correctly or ethically, but we've never dealt with something at this scale. I think it's really interesting to hear your take on that. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to the studios as it involves like the way that you bring about AI and your integration? You're not with a specific post house or a VFX house that's getting hired to do this. Talk a little bit about that and the relationship and the process of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm encouraging, I think it's all in its infancy right now, to a degree, as far as implementing it into any sort of a pipeline, and using it in any sort of a meaningful way. I mean, there's smallish tools implemented in the programs that are being used right now. And you're right, I'm not with any particular vendor or any particular visual effects house. I operate independently. But I am encouraging the vendors to come up with their game plan and how they're utilizing AI, how it's going to help the studios, how it's going to help overall costs, how it's going to help overall production and workflow, and what they're going to be able to. So, using that as selling points for the studios to keep my, I have a handful of maybe a dozen or so vendors that I work with on a regular basis, and so I'm just encouraging them to come up with a spiel, if you will, of how they're going to be pressing. Because right now the studios, that's all they've got the buzzwords in their minds, and they're like AI, like how can we use this to make our production more productive, and to make things go smoother, to produce more for cheaper. That it all comes down to money. For me, I think it's exciting because it enables creativity has no limits when it comes to implementing tools that AI give us. I think it's gonna enable us to expand even further with our creativity and the, you know, not just for us, but I mean for the filmmakers as a whole, for the directors, for the producers. You know, if they think it, we can do it. And I think that's even going to be more so the case in the coming year or two. And I mean, typically we can do anything right now, right? But money is always a factor. And I think things will be even become more financially feasible the more AI is introduced.
What's one way that you've used machine learning, neural networks, artificial intelligence in your work, or that you're encouraging others to use?
Me personally, right now, the only way I've utilized it is in concept art, but it's not the way you think. Like, I don't use Midjourney or anything and just create things strictly from text prompts. I'm using a more Photoshop because I do a lot of conceptual work for the shows that I work on to get vendors going in the right direction. So there are, you know, I think Photoshop's generative AI features are really nice, and being able to add elements into pieces of art. I like that. I think, you know, with Midjourney and things like that, while they produce really good results, it's like pulling a lever on a slot machine. You know, it's just, you never know exactly what you're going to get. And to do, you know, to make creative adjustments on those pieces is very difficult right now. So I like the tools that ensure that the artist is actually engaged. I'm not a big fan of just like text prompts. And I don't think text prompts will be the way that things go.
The Adobe Photoshop is so great. The extend. I hope they add that to After Effects at some point, like with Sora becoming more popular and like video generation becoming popular. It'd be so nice to be able to just like, client needs it to be 50 pixels wider, and instead of like stretching, I can just like fill it in. Like,
yeah,
I feel like that's the use case I find myself in the most. It's just like extending an image or something
for specific tasks like that. Sure, that's great. But like, you know, like I was saying, text prompts, as far as producing an entire movie from text prompt, it's just not doable. It will severely hinder the creative process. And I don't think anybody, no director or writer or producer or showrunner is gonna be able to put up with that. And I ultimately, maybe like there's been some pretty bold predictions around how quickly you're gonna be able to make an animated film from start to finish within the next 3 years. And, you know, 6 months at 1/10 of the labor force. And this is all based on this text prompt video creation. And I don't think that is going to actually happen. I think, you know, you're basically putting all your marbles in the fact that the AI is going to get exactly what you want based on something you type into a computer, and that's never the case. It's not now, and I don't think it will be in 3 years. I don't think it'll be in 10 years. I think, you know, I think the artistry has to still be involved. And I also think, you know, just I want to end on the fact that, you know, I think we as a society are going to demand art and entertainment that is still human created and human backed. I mean, just from a true art, you know, someone who really appreciates art myself, like, yeah, these AI images that are produced these days, they're pretty pictures. They look nice, but I get so much more from going and staring at a Van Gogh painting for hours and thinking about the emotion and the thought that went into that. Whereas these AI images, like, there's no thought, nothing goes into it. You know, I think half of the interest, like whenever I watch a movie or a TV show that I really enjoy, while I enjoy watching the show itself, the other half of that is actually doing a little research on the behind the scenes. And actually seeing like what went into it, what kind of thought process went into the story, you know, what's behind it, the creative process behind the costumes, set design, like that's all extremely interesting to me. And not just because I'm in the entertainment industry, I think that's interesting to a lot of people. And I don't think, and you won't get that with just AI created content. So I think there's always gonna, I think we will demand things to be human created still.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Like, I think you see with a lot of stuff on Disney Plus getting added, especially with like breakdowns are like whole series now, you know, like they have full, like the assembled series for Marvel stuff, or I think there's one for Star Wars too, for like Mandalorian. That's just like how it's made, and people are interested in that. And I think they like seeing talented people do stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like that's not gonna go away. In the same way that we like watching athletes who are like at the top of their game be like amazing. We love to see things that people can make that we never thought were possible. Yeah.
Exactly.
I love that. I think that's great to hear optimism towards it too. Cause I think there's so much cynicism in our community around AI, and like it feels very much kind of like people are scared and they feel like it's gonna take their jobs. But
balanced. And if you look at the history of like whenever there are big changes afoot, there's always a great deal of fear around it. Like, how are we going to adjust? But we always do. We make the adjustments necessary, and we go on as an industry. And that's happened time and time again in multiple industries. So there's always fear around big change. But I do feel confident that we're going in a good direction, and there will be some growing pains, but we'll sort it out. And we're going through some growing pains right now, but I think it's going to be sorted. It'll be for the best for everyone involved.
I'd love to hear about your experience going to India and working in Bollywood, especially as a VFX director. There's like some crazy VFX that go on in a lot of those movies. So I'm really curious how that's influenced like your view of VFX and kind of like the differences between Bollywood and Hollywood, and just kind of, how the approaches are different, what they look like.
Well, yeah, I mean, Indian cinema is very different from Hollywood cinema. It's they just do things because they can at times, which is great because people love it. You know, people love to see something explode. For no apparent reason, or like I'll give you a good example. I worked on this film where we were in downtown Mumbai, and then we shifted into a song sequence, and we were at Machu Picchu for whatever reason for the song, and then boom, we're back in downtown Mumbai as soon as the song is over. So why do we go down to Machu Picchu? I don't know, because it's not downtown Mumbai, and it's pretty and it looks cool, and. Yeah, but that's the thing, is that they like the song sequences that take place in Indian cinema. Like every film has at least 5-6 song numbers. That's an escape. You know, that's an escape for the viewers, for the film as a whole. It's an escape from the story, and people really enjoy it. It's viewed as a means of escape from it all, and. Yeah. So, but that's the way they do things over there. Films are made in a much different way. Obviously wages are quite different in India than they are, on this side of the world. They'll have someone stand on the side and hold a light because that's cheaper than actually putting it on a light stand. Just instances like that. But they do have, they produce more films in India than they do in Hollywood, and it's the movie capital of the world. So I'm not sure if everyone realizes that, but yeah, they produce more films over there. There's multiple industries. There's Bollywood, there's Tollywood, which is the South Indian movie industry. And that happens to have like Ramoji Film City just outside of Hyderabad, India, which is the largest film studio in the world. There's a lot of the Indian population, the Indian people, they have just a love of cinema, and that's they're so passionate about their movies, even more so than we are in North America.
How'd you get involved with that, and what was your motivation for doing it?
Well, I was an artist still at the time. I was a CG supervisor, and a studio in India reached out to me if I wanted to come over and supervise the film for them. And I thought it would be a great way to start in being as a visual effects supervisor, because I always wanted to be a visual effects supervisor. I always wanted to oversee the whole creative process. I mean, that was my dream. and that would be a way, my avenue into it. And that's basically what it did. So it was an eye-opening experience. I was there for 6 months, and I forged a lot of relationships there when I was there, and I still work with those guys. Those guys always are on the studio that I actually worked with over there. They're always on my shows, and they do a great job for me. So I still talk to them and have some great friends from my time there.
What was that experience like moving from movies and film like that to, I guess you'd worked on some TV shows prior, I believe, right?
When I first came back, I went back into television. I was doing Falling Skies when I first came over here. So I moved into visual effects supervisor on Falling Skies, which was like a post-apocalyptic alien invasion show. And Steven Spielberg was the executive producer. And then I did a bunch of other TV shows, just here and there. I was a CG supervisor on the Twilight films. There were multiple shows. I don't need to list them all right now, but the biggest thing for me was when I went over to a show called The 100, which was produced by Warner Brothers. It aired on the CW and was also on Netflix. And that was a post-apocalyptic show, and I did that for 6 seasons, and I was the overall visual effects supervisor for that. We got nominated for an Emmy in our first season, and we lost to Game of Thrones with 1/10 of the budget the Game of Thrones had. So to be nominated with them with that kind of budget and resources was really an honor, and we were very proud of it. Mm-hmm. And then I did Almost Human with Jay Wirth, who just did, he was the visual effects supervisor on Fallout, and he ran an Emmy for Westworld. So I did Almost Human at Fox with him. But anyway, that was all sprinkled in there. And then, but The 100 was the big show for me that I did right before Shogun. Mm-hmm. The pandemic came. I directed an episode of The 100 in the last season, but then the pandemic came and shut us down. I was done for about 8 months out of work. And then suddenly Shogun just kind of fell into my lap. And which was a dream come true, because I lived in Japan when I was a kid. That was part of my childhood story that I left out when I said selling you the backing. But yeah, I lived in Japan as a kid. Very fond memory from when I was younger was watching the original series with my dad on our first VHS player. Probably a little bit before you guys' time, but I don't know. When were you guys born?
The show, or do you mean the VHS player as a technology before our time?
The VHS player as it's both.
No, both. I have fond memories of sticking that VHS tape in the rewinder, the speed rewinder. It would rewind it real fast. I didn't have to stick my pinkies or pencils in there and do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had the stickers on them that said, be kind, rewind, the ones you got from Blockbuster. God forbid you don't bring it back rewound. You get charged an extra dollar. I watched the show with my dad in Japan as a kid, and that was a very fond memory. My dad was a huge James Clavell fan, huge fan of the show. So when I actually got hired on the new iteration of Shogun, having spent that time with my childhood, and really developed a love of all things Japanese, Japanese culture, Japanese traditions, just Japan as a whole. It was a very special, special show to get hired on. I was really excited. My dad was super excited too. And he was so proud of that. And as a result of that, it made me really happy. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, about halfway through production, my dad passed away. So he never got to see Shogun, but it gave me that much more motivation to make something special and really drive this hard. And I did. I I was very specific of what we, the level of quality we needed to get to in post with all of our vendors.
I offer condolences. I'm sorry that your father passed away in the midst of you making this show.
So sorry.
Real quick, what do you think would be like his favorite, one of his favorite moments or a favorite thing you would have loved in the show?
He loved the chess game that Torunaga played. I mean, if you watch the show,
there's so many nuances, especially at the end, at the last episode, there's so many little aha moments, very subtle aha moments.
I'm hoping that everybody listening right now has seen the show, and like at the end, when he's about to, when he's having his moment with Yabushige, he says to Yabushige, he says, why tell a dead man the future? And that's going back to episode one when Yabushige said that to his nephew Omi about Torunaga. He's like, well, they wanted to keep the ship. The fact that they had John Blackthorne's Erasmus ship, didn't want to tell Torunaga that. And he said to Omi, why tell a dead man the future? Assuming that soon Torunaga was going to be dead because Ishido was going to kill him. So, boom, that tells you right then and there that Omi was always with Torunaga. His nephew was always with Torunaga, and Yabu knew it. And that's why he like went ahead and stabbed himself in the stomach and looked at Torunaga and smiled with that smirk, because the guy just was brilliant. So my dad would have loved that. But from a visual effects standpoint, I think my dad probably would have loved the earthquake sequence at the end of five. That was one of my favorite sequences, just because it was such a technical undertaking, but also such a storytelling moment, because up until that moment, Torunaga had all the chess pieces in his favor, and he had his 100,000 strong army, and that wiped out like 85% of his army. So he couldn't, then he had to really play the chess game and really kind of maneuver through the mental game of it all. And that was that made the story that much more interesting, in my opinion. So it was also a technical, achievement, but it was also a very significant portion of the story that utilized visual effects to tell. And that's what I love most about visual effects is using it in service of the story, as seamless as possible to keep everyone immersed.
That scene was absolutely insane. And before we had the show planned, or before we hop on the show with you, we put it out to like any listeners, any questions for you. Yeah. And the questions we got back were about that scene and wanting to hear about the earthquake scene. Can you talk about like the technicality of it? I want to hear how you did it, how you achieved it, challenges you had.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had our practical location, right? And our practical location actually was, it actually overlooked a body of water. And we did have a real mountain on one side, just adjacent to our practical location, our practical set. And that, it was a smallish mountain, but it was big enough. And we used a drone to extensively photograph that mountain. And then we took height elevation data. And we used all those photographs and that elevation data to reconstruct a perfect replica of that small mount next to our set. And then because the set, the practical location, actually needed to overlook the encampment, Torunaga's encampment, everything else, including the mountain, became a full 3D environment. So everything was CG beyond our beyond our immediate location. And then because we did build that mountain to scale, and exactly like the actual real one that was there, it ensured that the landslide simulation that we were going to do with the CG replica mountain would behave correctly to the scale of our actual location. So it made it that much more real. We had the trees at the correct size, the correct height of the mountain, like everything was at the correct scale. And that's crucial when you want to make something that looks right. Like if the landslide's too fast or if it's too slow, there's going to be something that just doesn't look real about it. So that was real important from that. Now, even in certain shots, and sometimes we even swapped out the entire ground underneath our actors. Like we had one shot where two of the samurai, two of Torunaga's samurai guard get swallowed up by the ground. So we actually shot two real actors on the ground. We had a stunts and special effects. They placed two stunt actors there, and they placed on more or less like a carpet underneath some ground and kind of buried the carpets. And then basically pulled those carpets that was supposed to be a landslide. So those guys fell down and started sliding across the ground. Now you could see the carpets in the actual footage. The landslide simulation wasn't really there. I mean, we wanted to be much more eventful than that. We were probably at a level 2. We needed to be at a level 11. I would say let's go to 11. So we ended up replacing the entire ground, rotoing those guys out of the frame, and replacing the entire ground with a landslide simulation. But then we did match move geometry on those two actors. So we liked the actors. We liked the action they did, but we wanted them to get swallowed up by the ground. So we did match move geometry of them, where we did two digital characters and just animated them based on the action of our actual practical guys. That ensured that our landslide simulation would then interact with our practical guys correctly, because it was actually interacting with the match move guys that were based on them. So then we were able to make the ground come and swallow them and take them up. Like, we wanted it to be very clear that those two guys didn't make it. So then we did multiple scenes like that where we placed the entire ground. There's one scene where Torunaga, the ground underneath him collapses and he falls. So that was basically the whole ground was replaced. The one shot where we have of Hiro Sanada, the guy who played actor who played Torunaga, where he falls down as the ground is, he basically just fell to his knees out of frame. He just dropped down himself, did a really good job of that. And then we cut to the reverse of him, and we animated, but we shot a reverse him standing there, and then we animated him falling down and did the whole ground collapsing underneath him. That was all CG, of course.
Is that just like the most fun thing ever to just be able to be like, let's just replace the whole scene. Let's make it look exactly like this. That just sounds so fun.
It is. And it's nice it's nice when we have incredible vendors like ILP did that scene. And when they're like, hey, you know what's going to really work for us? We just replace this all and we make it all CG. I'm like, yeah, great. Let's do that. Let's do it. Because ultimately it gives us full control then over it all. And we did that on several scenes. You know, we did that on the cliff scene in episode 1, where they come over the top of the cliff and they're looking down and Rodriguez is there when they go to get Rodriguez after the storm. And that's everything over the cliff there, that's all CG. You know, that's there's a CG Rodriguez, there's a CG rocks, there's a CG ocean. Nothing is real. We're looking at a blue screen. It's all a simulated ocean, rocks. So the whole environment is CG. So, and we did shoot an element down there that it was okay. We had some rocks in a water tank that we used, but it didn't really give us the freedom to make to do the waves like we wanted to do. So we opted to go ahead and just replace it all and made it a full CG environment. So
That's so awesome. I wonder one question that I was thinking about, like on a lot of smaller budget stuff, right? Like the constraint is always like price. It's usually money. And like, how much can we do for this? What's it like to be working on something where, I mean, I'm sure price is still a factor, but where they're kind of like, you can do whatever you need to get this done. Is that like really liberating, or is it kind of like frightening, or is it, what's that feel?
No,
like?
I mean, look, you're absolutely right. Like we didn't want to go, you know, we didn't just want to, we always kept price in mind. You know, to a degree, creativity was always first and foremost, but we always had to make sure that we were doing things within reason. And I mean, we could have easily spent twice as much as we did on this show. And so I had to find vendors that were willing to work with us on price that were also very talented. But to that end, effects did give us all the support we needed. You know, when we needed to go somewhere with something, they gave us that support, but they knew also that I was being mindful of prices, like getting some tax credits here and there and what have you, working with some vendors that could that could work with us, because we got some bids early on from certain vendors. I'm not going to mention any names, but the prices were insane. Just you know, very, very high, much higher than. And in the beginning, our budget was actually quite a bit smaller than what it ended up being. I think when the realization came that we had something special, a good show here, and when Disney actually saw it, you know, the backing, the financial backing was there, and they wanted to. And a lot of the visual effects were invented in post. Like, we didn't shoot necessarily for it all the time. We would shoot a high appetite version and a low appetite version for some of the bigger shots. Like, they could work either way. But a lot of the big world building shots, the big scopey shots, like, we decided on those, you know, once we actually got to post in the edit, because that's a show that we decided eventually that we wanted to be made, or that everyone wanted to make. So yeah, it was good to have that backing, that support. It was refreshing, because it was very different like that on my previous show. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We really had to come up with very creative ways to do things, we wanted to do. And that can also be unpleasant, because it forces me to really demand a lot from the vendors for as little money as possible. And that can just make everything into an uncomfortable situation. So it was nice to ensure that the vendors were happy, because they produce great work, and to get that support with effects just meant the world.
What program are you guys using for the, like, doing a lot of the world building as you're recreating the mountain and all that stuff?
ILP, the one that did the mountain, they have their own proprietary effects software that does their water simulations, and I believe they use that for their mountain collapse too. I didn't get into too many technical specifications with them. I know for, like, the cities for Osaka, our vendor SSVFX in Dublin, they used Houdini procedural system to actually build the city that could be easily switched around for different views and different vantage points. That became a really good system for them and for us, for adjusting for different shots, different parts of the city that needed to be seen, because it enabled, like, really high-res buildings to be placed towards camera. And also to easily change up the view as needed. So that's what they used. There's, like, lots of Maya. Everything was comped in Nuke. And then we had one vendor use Unreal for some of the castle set extensions for two of the scenes. That came out really nice. I think those buildings are indiscernible. I don't think you ever would call them out as visual effects for all those Unreal extensions. So, yeah, I was very happy with those
results.
That's
interesting. I think what we're really trying to do with this podcast is just kind of break down that barrier between, for people who are wanting to work on this stuff and the people who are, and just, like, what it takes and what they're operating in. So that's great to hear the different programs. As far as the VFX of Shogun go, one of the other questions we got was how much previs was used.
We didn't use as much previs as people would think. As I mentioned before, our budget was not as robust as it ended up being, especially early on in the pre-production phases. We did get some bids and some put together some possibilities around previs for certain scenes. Storm sequence was one. The cliff sequence in episode one was one. The boats leaving Osaka in episode three was another. And ultimately, we didn't do much. We did a lot of storyboarding. We did a lot of shooting boat models with an iPhone and setting up those shots to drop into a theoretical edit. So we did a lot of that. What we did do is, when we got to post, we did a ton of post-vids. So, you know, once we were done shooting, I went down to Los Angeles and spent 3 months there and with post, just to put that 103, that episode three edit together, and really use, you know, ILP was the vendor that did the ships leaving Osaka. They did, you know, we did probably 150 to 200 test animations, to just gray shade animations, just to fill in the gaps and rearrange everything. Like, that whole sequence, the whole ships leaving Osaka, really the way that the sequence plays out in the show was all decided and established in post. It wasn't established while we were actually shooting. We had an idea of maybe what it could be when we were shooting things. We made sure to get those key moments, but you know, we have scene 19 through scene 31, for instance. We have a scene 31 shot up here next to a scene 19 shot. We have scene 19 shots at the back, and scene, you know, everything's mixed up. Everything's mixed up because that's the way the sequence works now. So there was a lot of that. That was really the only episode where we really figured that out in post, as far as like what a sequence was going to be and what the story was going to be around it. You know, that was all established in post. With the earthquake, we knew what the earthquake needed to be. And again, we did a lot of previs. We did do previs for the earthquake we actually went out there and we shot some stuff on my iPhone with some of my crew, and we put together a little previs for the earthquake before we actually shot there. So that was good. And then we did a ton of post-viz around the earthquake as well, and figured out that sequence. Only, you know, and I think in a way that worked well for us because what we envisioned a sequence to be in pre-production usually wasn't what it ended up being in post-production. So it worked out well. It worked out okay for us. Yeah.
Was there any shots or like sequences in Shogun that you were really excited about making that got cut? Was there any secret ones that you were like, oh my gosh, this effect is going to be so cool? And then you get to the end and it's like, it's not going to work.
Well, I directed a really nice scene that got cut from the show, and I was disappointed in that. But I understood why. I mean, the episode was really long, and it wasn't really crucial. It was when you know, the poor guy, Peter Zoom. When Peter Zoom gets boiled in episode one. So I actually directed his funeral scene. We had a scene in the show that was his funeral, and it was a gorgeous scene. We had a camera pushing in low, sun coming through the trees. It was a fall afternoon, a sunny fall afternoon. All the trees were golden, and we just got some gorgeous shots of the funeral. It was a very short scene with Miraji and Omi and some of the other players, but it was a really beautifully shot scene. And even the showrunner called me on the next morning. It was a Saturday. We shot it on a Friday. Called me Saturday morning when I was at breakfast with my family. He's like, this is stunning. Like, thank me for getting this. It's actually absolutely gorgeous. And I was just over the moon. And it did make it into the original cut. The first cut that came out, it was there. And but ultimately we were at about like 85 minutes on the episode. We closest to 60, so that was one of the scenes that got cut. From a visual effects standpoint, though, no, mostly everything. I wanted the earthquake sequence to be a little bit longer. That really got cut down, but maybe it's more impactful now. But nothing of note really got cut. Other than that little scene that I directed, that I was pretty proud of.
I'm curious if you can speak more to what it takes to be a VFX supervisor. And I ask that coming off of the back of hearing you directing a scene in the show. Is that common? And are there correlations between being a director and taking that ownership of vision and VFX supervising?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of visual effects supervisors do second unit directing. A lot of that has to do around capturing points of the visual effects. But from time to time, I do shoot things with main cast and that things that are crucial to story. For me, it really offers a window into the director's head. It offers a window into the showrunner's head, even more so. You know, really, really understanding how that's related to the story and just giving me a better understanding overall of the story. Because ultimately, as a visual effects supervisor, what we're storytellers. We're creative storytellers, and we utilize visual effects in order to tell the story. You know, it's my job as a visual effects supervisor to figure out how this shot is telling the story, how it's enhancing the story, what point of the story needs to be told here? How does this fit into the edit? You know, it's so much more than just putting the pixels in a frame. It's really figuring out how that, you know, the style that the story calls upon at that point in time and how that's going to fit into to everything. So directing only gets me more involved in that process and more integrated into the overall storytelling process. And I think it just ultimately just helps everyone. It helps the show as a whole.
I think we heard earlier too, you talked about kind of meshes with the same ideas of how like visual effects should only ever support the story, right?
That's right.
And how it's like, it needs to be in service of the story.
Yeah.
How do you balance or go about creating shots that don't do like too much where it like takes away from the story? And like, how do you kind of balance making something look really cool and really appealing and also like making sure that it serves the story?
Well, that you just want to make sure that everything is grounded, that it's really, mm-hmm. it's grounded in reality. Like this is actually what's going to happen. Or, you know, if you go anything beyond that, then things are going to stick out as a visual effect. You know, the last thing we want anybody to think about when watching the show is the fact that they're watching a visual effect. You know, we want you to be completely immersed in the story. We want you to be immersed in the world of the show. And, you know, even if it's a good visual effect, we don't want people saying like, oh, look at this good visual effect. This is great. I heard, you know, people talk about the end of episode four. Like I've heard so many people want to talk about the end of episode four. That's when Joe's and his men are shot with the chain shot cannons. And a lot of those conversations begin like, surely, were you guys involved in that? Like, how did you achieve that? And yeah, of course we were involved in a big way. Like those are full, you know, for the real violent shots, those are full CG guys getting ripped apart. But to my point is that mostly people aren't thinking about the fact that they're looking at a visual effect when that is happening. And that's all we want. So just being able to have things grounded in reality, like for example, that going back to that scene, we did multiple physics simulations around what would actually happen when that happened. For the beheading scenes, you know, these violent scenes, we did multiple physics simulations based on the weight of a human head, what the rate of rotation is based on the sharpness of the blade coming through the neck of someone, and how that would affect the spin rate, the velocity, and how fast the gravity would take over and drop the head. Like we wanted that all to be as real as possible. Everything needed to be grounded in reality. That was a mandate from the very beginning on this show. It had to be, we had to have a plausible explanation behind everything. It had to look real. And it, again, I can't say the word grounded enough. Like it just had to be grounded. I think, you know, I think there's a wealth of invisible effects throughout the show. You don't even realize our visual effects. You know, case in point is throughout the cannon training in episode four. You know, that training field is going to be the same field where Torunaga comes in with his army and sets up camp in episode five. So at the end of episode five is the earthquake and mountains from all sides collapse and come and bury his army in that earthquake. Well, we shot that in episode four in an area that's not mountainous at all. There's no mountains anywhere near that field. So we had to do, you know, 100+ shots of just adding mountains to that field in service of the story, because we knew it was going to happen in episode five. But I don't think when you watch episode four, no one knows that those are visual effects mountains anytime you see mountains. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the army that we added, like multiple CG guys in that scene. But that's a perfect example of how, you know, throughout this series, we did invisible work. There weren't too many exterior scenes in the show that were untouched by visual effects. So, and even in the interior scenes, like all of the oil lamps, those were LED lights that we had to add flames to. So, you know, that's another one. So it's just, there's so much that's, I think, is invisible. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's like the marker of like a lot of the most impactful shows and movies is when you're not distracted by visual effects. Like a lot of like superhero movies or like big sci-fi movies like that, where you are like so conscious that things are fake.
Yeah.
It's like so distracting. But I think like, I don't know, one of my favorite movies, like Dune or even Dune 2 now, like all of those are very clearly CG. Like
yeah.
a lot of the stuff is very obvious, but you like don't think about it. Like all the ships are so like real looking.
Yeah.
All the sand is so grounded and it just like makes it so like immersive and powerful. And, like you feel like you're there. And so, yeah, I just think that's such a cool perspective. I think that's so, so awesome.
Yeah. Dune's a great example. And, you know, we mandated early on that the visual effects were all to be grounded in reality, you know, grounded in real physics. Everything was extensively researched, but it also had to be grounded in history. You know, it had to be accurate. It had to be an authentic representation of 16th or 17th century feudal Japan, 1600, Sengoku era. And this world in this period in Japanese history has never been depicted on screen like anywhere near this magnitude, you know. And so we wanted to, it was really important for us to get this right, especially from a production, you know, with stemming from Hollywood and not from Japan. So we did ensure like we had some Japanese advisors, we had some Japanese historians, but we did extensive research. Like we did 9 months of prep. We did 9 months of prep on this. And a majority of that time was doing the research around the show. You know, everything from costumes to the production design, and that naturally just carried into the visual effects, you know, right down to the last detail, the last kind of shingle, the last kind of rooftop. Like we researched the materials that the roofs were in this building and that building, and because this world doesn't exist anymore. I mean, they have reproductions of some of the castles that are in the show that are built now, but they don't look anything like what they actually looked like back then. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to actually find an accurate representation of what the castle looked like, or the layout of what, like, say, Osaka Castle or what Osaka City. There's a lot of maps that vary because geography just wasn't that accurate. So, you know, through the help of some of our historians, especially a gentleman named Frederick Krenz, who's a professor at Kyoto University and considered the world authority on this period of Japanese history. He was able to help us really weed through a lot of that because there's a wealth of information, but a lot of it's not that accurate. He helps us weed through a lot of it and find the real information, even almost something as close to a blueprint of what the Tenshu, the main tower of Osaka Castle, looked like in 1597, which is, you know, 3 years before our story, but would be what that actual building looked like. So we built something very accurate. We built a depiction of Osaka that's very accurate to the time period. And again, I don't think, you know, it had never been done before. Like you'd never seen Sengoku era Osaka, the whole city on screen. So that was a huge point of pride for us because like our cast, our Japanese cast and the Japanese crew that was involved in the show, they were so passionate and emotionally invested. And because of our relationship with them, we became emotionally invested. And we really wanted to be, you know, to honor the Japanese history and the accuracy and the authenticity of this period in Japanese history. And so we did everything we possibly could to do that. We wanted not only an American or North American audience to appreciate this show, but we wanted a Japanese audience and beyond, a worldwide audience, and especially a Japanese audience, to see this and actually look at it and say, wow, they got it right. Like they took great care to honor our traditions, to honor our culture, to honor this period in history. And we did. And I think the show is done very well in Japan. And that's a true testament to all of the work, the painstaking, tireless effort that was put into getting this show as authentic as possible.
Yeah, I love that. It's so cool to hear.
That is absolutely wild hearing the depth that is, the amount of hours that is spent on trying to make something this accurate. And Michael, just want to say thank you so much for offering your time and advice and wisdom and insight into how this was made. We could talk about it for hours, as I'm sure you could, and you absolutely. As you have, I'm sure. As a final question, I'm kind of curious what you as a VFX supervisor look for in VFX artists? Or more so, what advice would you give to VFX artists looking to work on these kinds of stories at this scale?
I don't like to think of artists as visual effects artists as artists so much as I like to think of them as storytellers, like myself. I think as a filmmaker, whether that be a writer, whether that be a costume designer, a production designer, or a visual effects artist, you're, in essence, you're a storyteller at the end of the day. And so everything you do, everything every department does, is in service of the story. And that's the main attraction, right, is the story. And we are here to enhance the story. And so it's not about what kind of a visual effect we can make or how good we can make this look strictly from a visual effect standpoint because it looks cool. It's how does this actually tell the story? How does this enhance the story? How does this immerse the viewer? And that's the key, you know? So I look for people who think like that from a storytelling perspective. Not that this is the latest technology, we can do this. I mean, sure, that's part of it, but that's not really what it's about. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, we're here to tell a story, and that's how you have to think of this as storytelling.
So just closing out here, I would love to hear how people can keep up with your work, how they can keep up with Shogun and other projects that you might be working on. What's the best place to follow you?
You can follow me on Instagram at Michael Cliett, MichaelCliett. And we're going to be posting some before and afters coming up, as well as our For Your Consideration video will be up on that. You can find me on LinkedIn at Michael Cliett. Happy to have you follow me on LinkedIn as well, or become my connection. And then you can follow the show at Shogun FX. So it's just like that, FX produced it. It's at Shogun, letters F and letter X. And that's that'll have all things related to Shogun and maybe some official news coming really soon about the future. So,
oh, very mysterious.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. My pleasure.